Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 203 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet and journalist Donny O'Rourke welcomes the tentative beginnings of spring, introducing us to the Celts' pagan festival of Imbolc and taking us on a whistle-stop tour of the coastal East Nook of Fife. Then, novelist Mavis Cheek explains how writing always came easily to her, even when schoolwork didn't. First, here's Donny O'Rourke on Imbolc.
With all due respect to Vivaldi and pizza, maybe four seasons aren't enough. Chinese poets of the Tang Dynasty had an extra one in which to feel even more sad. German ecological efficiency came up with Vorfrühling, Vorspring, which has nothing to do with cars. Such a preview of or trail of Vorspring could come in guy handy in Scotland, where winter is given far too long a run. In fact, the Celts, who did some of their finest Celting round a misty loch in Hallstatt, a suspiciously Scottish-looking region of Austria, believed in an optimistically early kick-off for spring. This festival they called Imbolc. As a devout Hiberno-Scot, observant in every sense, I hold with this custom, whose patroness worked both sides of the spiritual street as pagan deity and Christian saint. Bridget's feast falls on the 1st of February, when, with a little luck and a lot of prayer, the snowdrops and crocuses will already have raised their heads and our morale. The nights are fair drawing out. Light isn't just a memory and a hope in a country that half hibernates for half the year, but a literally luscious presence as a low sun pits its rays against the rain, charming and chiding January's glower with the bashful glare of an incipient semi-season. If the year were a book, Bridget would be writing winter's epilogue and a preface to spring. Sleet and snow, however, can remain impervious to her blandishments. It's windy and wet, the worst weather yet in a wintry week. The weatherman's grim, according to him, the outlook's bleak. But there's a little more light, brighter each night, spring is on the way. The first bud or two will have broken through by St. Bridget's Day. The fortnight between the name days of Bridget and Valentine can be icy and dicey. Imbolc may derive from the Gaelic word for in the belly, an allusion to the pregnancy of ewes at this, the start of the lambing season. Before and after conversion, beds used to be made up for Bridget, saint and or goddess. Votive victuals were proffered and garments laid out for her blessing. Distinctively square Manx-style crosses were formed from rushes. One adorns and protects my kitchen. A time for divination. Badger sets would be inspected for signs of resuscitated life, a ritual which, having migrated to America, was renamed Groundhog Day. If only my ancestral Celtic cousins had secured the film rights. Anstruther is a bit too far east and south to register on the Celtometer, but a choice spot to experience that attenuated and subtle seasonal cusp, these liminal days of indeterminacy, this hinge and hyphen made of hope. It is almost too pretty, Anstruther. A perfect postcard of a place, too picturesque to picture. Close your eyes. Imagine a fishing village. Now open them. Welcome to Anstruther, Ainster in the local dialect. A fishing port without fish, unless you count the truly exceptional fish and chip shops. Haddock, heaven. A place that no longer makes anything, not even sense, without the tourists and holiday homers, frame-filling spear carriers in a pageant whose purpose is illusory and hollow-hearted, a no longer lively tableau vivant, a stage set, a simulacrum. This is harsh, an asperity born of affection, esteem, even love, vicarious nostalgia for good old days I never knew. Well, somewhat new. For a scout project, we conducted a survey of the likely economic, social and cultural consequences of closing the harbour to trawlers. That was in 1975. You didn't need to be a prophet or even prescient to see economic disaster looming. Anstruther got the excellent new Fisheries Museum. Pitt and Weems' traditional livelihood remained uncurated, working vessels rather than exhibits. In Anstruther, the daily catch was still being landed when I was a boy. My family was too poor or incurious for holidays, but Glaswegians less well off and less inquisitive than us made their way in raucous droves to the caravan parks and campsites of Anstruther, a destination more prized by many than the Clyde Coast resorts closer to hand, Dún the Watta. Traces persist in infrastructure and demographics, but not on that scale and scope of spree. The caravan berths got built on. This has become a sought-after village in which to dwell. By the look of the locals and the fertile lie of the land, there was and will be money to be made here and hereabouts. Lucre and learning. St Andrews perched prosperously just around the headland. The famous golf course, grandly green, its vaunted cathedral and photogenic ruins, the equally selfie-inducing university thriving, fit for a king, one might say. And they do. Try stopping them. Scotland's first university, as the stationery brags. There weren't as many Loud, Public School, Oxbridge, Rejects, and Louder, high net worth Americans. Top drawer meets top dollar back in 1410. As much town as gown, Stanza, the annual springtime poetry festival, could lay claim to being these islands' finest. Starry yet never stuffy, high powered but low key, international and still local, its astutely programmed events usually attract capacity crowds. It has frequently been my pleasure to perform and be performed to there. Lovers of classical music need not be restive, they too can feel festive. Anstruther's world-class chamber music festival is a polished gem of congeniality in a jewel box of a location. In fact, the music festival belongs to the whole East Nook, or corner of the never completely conquered Kingdom of Fife. No fan of fifers, King James VI, Jamie the Sixth, who would ascend the English throne after Elizabeth, described this as the fringe of gold around the beggar's mantle that was Fife. These unmistakably independent and individuated, contrastingly scenic neighbouring villages are linked by a well-kept and scenic coastal path. Our heads now full of nature's sonata for sea and seabird, let's start at Ely with its epic estuary, an immemorial dialogue between time and tide, an invigorating stretch of the legs between fields of corn and the Firth of Forth to St Monance, modest in scale and comportment, and a harbourfront hosanna to the heritage industry that has supplanted seafaring. Then on to Pitt and Weem and its hard-working harbour and sorbet-shaded terraces. Pitt and Weem, the bonniest lass I've ever seen. She guts the herring Dún by the quay and saves her kisses all for me. John Watt, evoking a romance with a place as well as a sweetheart. Next, Anstruther, to which we shall return, and seamlessly adjoining it, but its own quarter mile of creation in every particularity, Cellar Dyke. Quaintly quiet for decades in Victorian times, this was the second busiest harbour in Scotland. Chosen for its charm, this quarter is popular with weekenders. Dream houses need not be large. Thanks to the generosity of friends, I now spend my East Nook days in their trim and tiny flat, a sanctuary, a cell, that overlooks the sea wall to East Lothian, the Isle of May, the Bass Rock and North Dunbar. In summer, a wave-skimming rib brings you from there to here in half an hour. No ferry now. The trail to Crail will never fail to inspire a little awe, and the village itself is noted for the splendour of its harbour and the succulence of its crabs. One eats well in the East Nook. Prospective springtime pilgrim, in every steading on our peregrination, comely comestibles, tea rooms, cafes, chip shops, seafood shacks, a smokery, restaurants, delis, bakeries, a farm food boutique, and a nursery selling vegetables straight from the soil. Waiting at home, procured from the amiably expert Doig brothers at the top of the Bray and Cellar Dyke, are a lobster, halibut and scallops, all locally landed. I shan't be catering appeasingly for St. Bridget, but will raise a glass of Gros Plan to toast her abiding presence, not at all the same thing as her existence. A last ruminative turn round the harbour before an aperitif. Red paneled roofs, cottages built sturdy and wind-resistant from rough-hewn stone, the North Sea unwilling to choose a colour scheme, grey, no green, no blue, no that blue, mustardy lichen, ochre dulse, and the meadows mossy and sleek, the bleary bleat of those newborn lambs. Anstruther at Imbolc. A soulscape that surrounds and stays with me, even when I'm at home in Glasgow. For a few favouring years, I watched spring's gradual assertion of its claim on climate, cud and crop from the flower-potted patio of an abandoned boathouse renovated by the mother of a dear and darling friend. When leave had finally, definitively and bittersweetly to be taken, moping around an antique shop, itself soon to be forsaken, for a low, closing-down sale price, I bought four dining room chairs, an Art Nouveau side table, and a pine sea captain's kist. Almost as a premonition of the festival, decades before its inauguration, insouciantly on CD, as if refusing to mourn, the scherzo from an early Mozart quartet was playing. "I'll cover the furniture with this old carpet," the wryly phlegmatic owner said. "I'll throw it in. You can throw it out." I didn't. Exquisite but threadbare, amply proportioned, its hues faded, if fine, the rug scrubbed up well and turned out to be from Shanghai. It will celebrate its centenary next year. Like the rug stolen from the Big Lebowski, it kind of holds the room together, has done for 30 years. The provenance may be Chinese, but for me its blues and browns and greens and reds and golds and greys are the tints and tones of Fife and its own Far East, when, pent and patient, spring prepares to spring.
That was Donny O'Rourke, recorded by Conor McPhee. You can find out more about Donny on the RLF website. Next, here's Mavis Cheek with Like Shelling Peas.
The delightfully honest Alan Bennett talks about his talent for writing in Written on the Body, how he undervalued it, how he had actor written as his main occupation in his passport, and how it took him to near middle age before he called himself a writer. His talent for setting down words that meant something to the people who read them or acted them was something that he almost didn't notice. I know what he means. There's no doubt that I was given the gift of writing, that I knew from quite an early age how to put words together and how to invent stories is clear. I didn't mark it particularly. It came easily. Just as well as I was a lazy child, or at least a child not given to caring about things very much, not one to put my back into anything. So, to be good at words automatically meant I could just enjoy it. No one required me to make a great effort at whatever I was set to do, and no one told me I was good or bad or even indifferent. I'm not sure that anyone noticed. Certainly at my infant school, 5 to 8 years, the writing was not apparent. I was learning how to do it rather than sitting down to write imaginatively. But I did make up stories all the time, putting myself into scenarios that couldn't possibly be real. These were called lies and were either dismissed or heavily reproved. I never minded and was completely without conscience. One that I remember very clearly from when I was about 7 was telling my aunt that a dog had run off with her umbrella because it had a bone handle. It did, and this gruesome fact fascinated and bothered me when I borrowed it. An example of the little bit of grit in the oyster that goes on to become full-blown fiction, something that all we grown-up writers pray for. Later, at my junior school, 8 to 11 years, there was no particular singling out of my writing skills. Mostly the teachers concentrated on the boys. Looking back, that's clear. It was the age for it. And my compositions, which got reasonable marks, were not made much of. If anything, when I wrote at length and inventively, it was an achievement greeted with surprise, as if to say that that particular composition was uncharacteristic. A reaction by my teacher which bothered me not at all. I'd enjoyed writing it, and that was enough. I read and read and read. I loved stories. I loved Enid Blyton in particular, and Richmond Crompton's William, Paul Gallico, whose Jenny was the first book to make me cry, and Susan Coolidge's deliciously dashing Katie and What She Did. I used the local library every week, immersing myself in books. Until I was a teenager, we had no television, so books were everything. Stories were everything. I do remember how much I enjoyed writing them, and much as my writing today, I don't think I ever tried to write to please anyone. Not the teacher, not the fellow pupils, not my mother or sister. Nowadays I write and hope the readers will like it. Then I wrote with gusto, not even caring if anyone liked it or not. I wrote because I could and because it was a pleasure. That, surely, for any writer of any age, must hold true. If you're not enjoying what you're writing, then how will anyone else enjoy reading it? This is not the same as enjoying the process of writing, which most writers will tell you is a pain in the elbow. Displacement activity, vacuuming the curtains, tidying a drawer, buying a pint of milk or possibly gin, anything, anything, to avoid sitting down and starting to write. Of course, when you finally do sit down, then the words take over, you're off, and you forget the elbow and the pain in the mystical magic of the act. Not until senior school, 11 to 16 years, did I have homework. I'm assuming that was when I found somewhere to write at home. Certainly, there were no writing facilities when I was younger, and between the years of 5 and 11, none was required. We lived in two small back rooms, and the table was for meals and the preparation of meals, maybe reading the paper, maybe filling in the football pools, but not for sitting with a pen in your hand and paper before you and writing something of no use to anyone. I'm not sure how, once at senior school, I did my homework. There was no desk nor room for one in the living room, and the bedroom had a double and single bed crammed in for the three of us, mother, sister and me. There was a chest of drawers, and that was it. I probably did sit at the table, but I don't remember sitting there with a pen. It was at senior school, bit of a failure, put in a B stream, lazy, you see, and interested only in what I enjoyed, that a couple of teachers recognised that I was good at essays, good with words, a bit of a writer. And when the school held a concert, I wrote the verses to a song which two friends and I sang. The words and the rhythm came as easily as shelling peas. The teacher organising the concert was impressed. I think I was surprised that she was impressed. Why? It was what I could do, and very easily. Interestingly, when at 12 I edited our younger pupils magazine and wrote an editorial full of confidence and big words, the maths master, one Mr. Della Rocca, was highly sceptical and asked the class if I'd written it on my own or whether my father and mother had helped me a lot. My math skills were so poor that I can quite see why he would be incredulous. He was highly suspicious and very sardonic, but the class in unison said, as a matter of fact, "No, she's good at writing, sir." And then I added, thereby crushing any further Della Rocca jibe, that in any case, I did not have a father. Innocently offered as information, but looking back, the perfect way to silence an uppity teacher. I wasn't looking for a victory, but I got one. After school, I wrote no more stories. Of course, I wrote agonised teenage poetry, who did not? But the imaginative side of writing was, for the most part, buried. Except for the helpful fact that there was no internet, No email, no smartphones, and we didn't have a telephone at home. Instead, there were letters and the post. Throughout my teens and into my 20s, I wrote letters copiously, and I loved writing to my friends. I sometimes created completely arbitrary worlds for them in my letters, inventing surreal happenings and totally imagined situations, all for fun. Seldom did I write a letter which was purely informative in the strictest practical sense. I made friends laugh, and many of them have said since that they kept my letters and still have them. It was all so very easy and enjoyable, and for me, just more of my effortless pea-shelling. Those, then, were the years that shaped my writing without my having a clue that it was an amazing gift and an unusual talent, and that one day I would become a novelist and earn my bread by what I found came so naturally and enjoyably. Alan Bennett is in his 80s now, and he says of his copious and enduring oeuvre that he looks back at it in astonishment sometimes. And while I'm somewhere near the bottom of the pantheon on which he sits atop, he is a wonder, we have this thought in common. What luck, what incredible luck, to have been given the gift of writing.
That was Mavis Cheek, recorded by herself. You can find out more about Mavis on her website at www.mavischeek.co.uk. And that concludes episode 203, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 204, in another instalment of Location and the Writer, we visit a struggling seaside town, a childhood corner of Ireland, and London's winding Thames. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.